This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a recording of a GHIL lecture by Bernhard Kleeberg, Professor of the History of Science at the University of Erfurt, entitled Autosuggestion on the Early History of Advertising Psychology. In 1900, psychologist Harlow Stearns Gale published what is probably the earliest psychological study of advertising. His main interest was the process of convincing potential buyers by attracting their attention, suggesting a need and a product to satisfy it, and making its brand memorable. The lecture traces the historical background that made it seem necessary to stimulate consumption through new forms of advertising, and thus motivated the psychotechnical modeling of consumer behavior. Bernhard Kleeberg argues that to awaken and stabilize needs against the background of mass production and distance media, a new type of psychotechnology was required, autosuggestion.
Thank you very much, dear Professor Hodenberg, dear Ole Münch, for inviting me. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to be here, and I'm glad to be able to deliver this lecture on autosuggestion, the early history of advertising psychology, which is somehow, the paper itself is quite old, and I'm trying to rewrite it for a English journal, haven't decided which one, in the context of a new project. We have a collaborative research unit, I think that's the English name for Sonderforschungsbereich, which works on the structural changes of property. And within that context, we have a project which is on the early consumer society. And that's why I dig up this old paper and I rewrote it. And I'm happy to present it here. And I'm looking very much forward to your comments and questions. Autosuggestion on the early history of advertising psychology. In 1900, American psychologist Harlow Stearns Gale published what is probably the earliest psychological study in advertising. Gale, who, like many of his compatriots, had traveled to Leipzig to study psychology under Wilhelm Wundt, had been running an experimental psychological laboratory since 1895, where, by conducting experiments and relating them to surveys, he wanted to investigate the psychological mechanisms underlying advertising. His main interest was the process of convincing potential buyers. First, their attention had to be attracted in order to then suggest a need that they could satisfy by buying the product, the brand of which they had to remember. Obviously, it could no longer be taken for granted that buyers would buy a product anyway, just because it fits their needs. In this lecture, I will trace the historical background that made it seem necessary around 1900 to stimulate consumption through new forms of advertising, and then made it possible to model consumer behavior psychotechnically in the early 20th century. This calls into question the self-evident nature of consumer needs, still often assumed in economic theory and in social and consumer history, based on a history of knowledge about the generation and stabilization of needs. My thesis argues, however, that to awaken and stabilize artificial needs against the background of distance media and mass production, a new technique of applied psychology was required. And that is autosuggestion. With the consumer, the 19th century saw the birth of a figure fundamental to modern society. This figure was not only crucial as a social figure whose identity is defined by consumption, but as a communication figure in which the emerging consumer society reflected itself. It is in the consumer that the form of coupling production and consumption specific to modern industrial capitalism comes to expression, namely the suggestion or autosuggestion of needs. This suggestion / autosuggestion is necessary because the coupling itself had become fragile, and it is made manageable in a contemporary way by determining the psyche of the consumer. I will begin my lecture where the socioeconomic transformations of the 19th century become particularly clear, and that is in the advertising practice at the turn of the century. I will do this first of all in the image that serves as my title slide, an advertisement for the book Die Reklame, ihre Kunst und Wissenschaft, so advertising, its art and science, published in 1913 by the advertising expert Paul Ruben. It was intended as a guide for advertising consultants or, as the head of the Austro-Hungarian Ministry of Commerce, His Excellency, Privy Councillor Professor Victor Mataya, put it in his foreword, I quote, designed by men of practice and intended to be useful to other men of practice. It was to, quote again, improve the advertising industry objectively, morally, and aesthetically, a goal to which Moderne Reklame, a specialist magazine for business people founded in 1891 by the Zittau lawyer Robert Exner, had already dedicated itself 20 years earlier. In this context, two things are noteworthy. First, the book poster is advertising advertising. It is a second-order advertising, which can be understood as indicating a transformation that is important in the history of consumption and communication. In German, there's a distinction between Reklame and Werbung, and that's, I don't know how to put that in English, but that's what is meant in this context, and it can make clear this historical shift. Second, among the addressees and authors of the guide and the specialist journal, one group of experts that we might have expected to find there are missing, and that is psychologists. They are neither mentioned in the programmatic introductory contribution, which is called The Psychology of Advertising, nor does Ernst Growald, the director of the Berlin advertising agency Hollerbaum & Schmidt, include them in his contribution, which is called Reklame Fachleute, Reklame Sachverständige, Reklame Berater, Reklame Chefs, Reklame Genies, Reklame Techniker, Reklame Anwälte, Reklame Agenten. So that's the title of the, in English, it's the title of his paper is Advertising Experts, Advertising Specialists, Advertising Consultants, Advertising Supervisors, Advertising Geniuses, Advertising Technicians, Advertising Lawyers, Advertising Agents. So he basically, you know, named all of them except for psychologists. This raises various questions. We could ask, first of all, about the development of consumer needs, could ask how they are analyzed and molded. Didn't the practitioners themselves, the advertisers, need to have some notion of the psyche of the consumer they were trying to influence? Did this notion emerge from psychology as a science? And what conclusions can be drawn from the psychology of advertising and second-order advertising about the dawn of the modern consumer society? Does the intensive preoccupation with advertising indicate that consumption had declined around 1900, that there was insufficient consumption, or that the wrong products were being consumed? Researchers, by and large, agree that the rise of advertising and the dawn of the consumer society are closely intertwined. It was primarily advertising that pointed the way to the consumer society since the beginning of industrialization. To explain the phenomenon of advertising for advertising, however, it does not seem sufficient to point out that in the 19th century, economic and communicative innovations simply went hand in hand. Instead, I will follow up on considerations by Stefan Haas about the communicative function of advertising, which penetrates the anonymized market process and creates an intermediate sphere between subject and object. Behind this idea is the aforementioned vulnerability of consumption, the breakdown of the necessary and direct coupling of production and consumption, which had already been frequently noted in the 19th century. A hiatus had opened up between them, which many contemporaries noted and which refers to the Great Transformation. And this hiatus was associated with industrialization, increasing market integration, and mediated by money and the expansion of wage labor. Not only did the relationship between self-sufficiency and external supply via the market reverse over the course of the 19th century, but as a result of the expansion of trade, production, and the improvement of the transportation system, living standards rose and new options emerged that allowed consumption to increasingly detach itself from questions of subsistence and to instead serve social distinction. So the possession of goods as a basis for social participation compensates for property that cannot be acquired by the average citizen. And this is exactly what I referred to earlier on, what we are working on in the new project in the Collaborative Research Center on Structural Changes of Property. The dawn of the consumer society is generally seen against this socio-historical background. For my thesis, I make use of Thomas Welskop's definition of consumption as a mode in which the potential, I quote, final consumption is linked to the capitalist economic system. And I will try to address the question of how this mode is reflected in contemporary society and whether the link is understood as precarious. I thus suggest that the specific mode of coupling production and consumption in industrial capitalism consists in the suggestion of consumer needs. Consumer needs must be suggested because they are designed to increase within the framework of the capitalist logic of growth. They must be suggested because in an economy integrated through the medium of money, goods are detached from their production process and their intended use, and thus are no longer directly visible as such. Consumer needs can be suggested because goods produced in ever greater quantities are represented in an anonymized market structure by images circulating in the mass media. And the phenomenon of second-order advertising points to an important change. Advertising becomes a medium for mediating production and consumption, and as such, advertising becomes a medium for mediating itself as well. Still, goods do not simply have to be known, they have to be wanted, recognized, and bought by individual consumers. It is therefore not simply advertising as a communicative system, but the consumer who ensures the economic or mass media integration of society. As a communicative figure, the consumer serves to address need structures and consumption decisions, to discuss attention thresholds, correlations of associations, and the question of suggestibility. It therefore seems to be particularly fruitful to understand the generation of needs from the contemporary determination of the consumer psyche. And this I will try in three steps. The first step towards a technocracy of sensuality. At the end of the 19th century, advertising itself became part of the mass media, acting as an intermediary between providers and consumers, fighting for attention and therefore being advertised itself. As you might see here in some advertising posters. So this is advertising posters for printing companies. So for advertising posters for, you know, where to go when you want an advertising poster. Since the middle of this century, usually the great exhibition, Crystal Palace in Hyde Park, is being referred to. Since the middle of the century, this development was supported by newly emerging professions. Anzeigenagenturen, advertising agencies, for instance, experts in the various new advertising media, like those which you can see here, shop windows, advertising columns, billboards, trading cards. And towards the end of the century, advertising art studios and ad agencies. Then, in the early 20th century, market and consumer research firms. For instance, one of the best known is that of Harvard psychologist Daniel Stark and Staff, 1923, or in Germany a little bit later on, the Gesellschaft für Konsumforschung in 1935. These experts were not unaware of their mediating function by any measure. For example, the 1900 calendar and newspaper catalog of the Hasenstein and Vogler firm states that the cultural historian who examines the 19th century must determine the influence that the newspaper and its advertisement system has had on the development of society and economy in the service of supply and demand. I quote, this is in German, but I have translated that, quote, that this influence has had the most profound effect and that it has not only proved to be supportive and helpful for the enterprises of individuals, but has also had a reshaping and groundbreaking effect on all areas of culture in nation states cannot escape even the casual observer. Anyone who recognizes the importance of the press as a general formative and cultural tool will not hesitate to give the organization of the advertising system, which is closely linked to the newspaper system, the value it deserves from a practical point of view for the achievement of economic material goals. End quote. The advertisers of Hasenstein and Vogler obviously saw their business as a fundamental praxis for modern socialization. Founded in Hamburg-Altona in 1855, the agency already had 49 branches by 1892, and in 1889 it was converted into a joint stock company. This made self-commercialization possible, which was already evident in its own advertising. And the newspaper catalog, which initially served as an overview for advertisers, soon became an advertising medium in itself, in which newspapers wanted to be listed. Here, the advertising reflects itself. The system of advertising has closed, as Niklas Luhmann would have said. The Leipzig journalist Rudolf Kronau makes this particularly clear in his Buch der Reklame. In his overview of modern advertising, which is interspersed with numerous reports by and about advertisers and even shamans, he wrote in 1887 that advertising is, I quote, the medium without which the individual is neither seen nor heard in the general confusion, end quote. It is not for nothing that Kronau quotes the economist Karl Kneese, whose 1857 work, Der Telegraph als Verkehrsmittel, so the telegraph as a means of transport, or Verkehr means transport, traffic, socialization. Der Telegraph als Verkehrsmittel, this book can be considered as the first economic monograph on the structures and problems of communication markets. And I quote Karl Kneese, the advertisement not only provides information about supply and demand, it also directs people to the specific place where an existing need can be satisfied. By presenting the searcher with a reference to their destination, it saves them time and effort. And in doing so, it also becomes a major lever of competition. But the advertisement also stimulates consumption and production, provides the motivating impetus for buying and selling. When it communicates a desire, it offers the owner the opportunity to dispose of a good. It can give direction and purpose to the available productive forces. When it informs people about an offer, it stimulates buying and consumption. It gives purpose and direction to the available consuming
forces. End quote.
For Knies, it was up to the advertising industry to restore the interwovenness of the developing division of labor with the differentiation of production and consumption. This was a thesis Adam Smith had postulated, and it was still considered a law of nature when Jean-Baptiste Say formulated the theorem in his Traité d'économie politique in 1803 that all production automatically leads to consumption. The causal link between production and consumption, as assumed around 1800, had important consequences for the determination of needs. Although needs could vary depending on the level of civilization, status, and social class, it was self-evident that they existed. The problem that had to be solved was not the emergence or awakening of subjective needs, but the free circulation and distribution of goods. Say's concept of consumption implied a difference between natural and artificial needs, which was still being discussed at the end of the 19th century. On the one hand, there were natural subsistence needs, and on the other, there were acquired needs that were tied to the relationship of a culture to its environment. Such needs linked to the stage of civilization marked the opposite pole of necessity within the framework of the human need structure, the realm of freedom. Thus, at least in principle, they were a contingent object of the subject's decision, who was thereby empowered as a buyer. Now, if acquired needs were to play a role as a driving force for economic and civilizational development, they had to be stabilized, to be made permanent again and again. They had to become natural needs to make room for new artificial needs of a higher level, and thus ultimately guarantee the growth process that underpins the modern capitalist market economy. This was achieved through the development of consumption habits as parts of a second nature. As such, however, they carried the risk of blurring the distinction between what was necessary and what was superfluous, between true and false needs. It was therefore important to observe, control, and discipline them. And the habituation of needs was increasingly viewed positively, and people demanded that this mechanism be used to their advantage. The difference between true and false needs became apparent when comparing cultures or social classes. Knie's colleague Wilhelm Roscher pointed out in 1849 that even though it led to productive activity and thus ultimately had a civilizing effect, consumption had been neglected since Adam Smith. In his System der Volkswirtschaft in 1854, he spoke about the emergence of new needs. Among people themselves, those who have very few needs tend to prefer rest to work. Therefore, if European merchants want to establish trade with completely savage peoples, they must regularly begin by giving their nails, axes, mirrors, brandy, etc. to these people as gifts. End quote. What Roscher describes here, against the background of the overproduction crisis of the early 19th century, is the targeted awakening of new needs by means of generating a feeling of pleasure that, as a result of regular repetition, turns into a need that must be satisfied again and again. It is a consumption need that refines the cruder needs that drove people at lower levels of culture, as Roscher sees it. Even if they supposedly mark a higher level of civilization, new artificial needs generated in this way are not unproblematic, as is shown by Roscher's example of the changing opinions on consumption of fashion, which he attributes to the changeability of moods. In doing so, he evokes moral philosophy from the late 18th century that rejected moods as the rule of emotion and linked them to the loss of the economic virtue of foresight, Moods were considered a disease of civilization triggered by luxury consumption. Roscher took up the psychological mechanism of the association of sensory impressions that was considered to underlying moods. Half a century later, however, he did this as a representative no longer of the moral sciences, but rather of the social sciences. The changeability of moods had now become an economic mechanism, a basic prerequisite for progress.
Quote,
"The same caprice that lowers the value of one good raises that of another. What has gone out of fashion among the rich may now become more accessible to the poor. Moreover, the need to vary enjoyment is too particular to man and is too closely connected with his ability to progress for us to be able to criticize it in and of itself." This interpretation of economic activity reflects my thesis of stabilizing a consumption that has become fragile by suggesting consumer needs. Because the way to evoke these needs by appealing to the senses and by associating a good with feelings of pleasure seemed economically sensible and socially legitimate, even necessary. Such a technocracy of sensuality, which Wolfgang Fritz Haug saw as already inherent in the subordination of use value to exchange value, was sharply criticized by Marx in his Paris Manuscripts in 1844, and he described the product as bait, quote Marx, by means of which one wants to lure the other person's money. Every real or possible need is a weakness that will lead the fly to the glue stick. End of quote. Thus, the industrial capitalist plays, another quote of Marx, the matchmaker between the central nature of the money owner and his need. And he arouses abnormal desires in him. I come to my second chapter, Attention and the Idiomotorics of Advertising. How exactly, I would like to ask in the following section, does the appeal to the senses, which economists and advertising experts talk about in their own specific way, work? How does one go about efficiently, as Kronau puts it, to cleverly attract attention in order to influence people? How does one set up advertising or the purpose of awakening lust and capturing the will, as the pedagogue Christian von Dillmann asked in 1891. Kronau gives the following advice. Attention can be attracted by a different position in the sentence, by forms, repetitions, contrasts, bars, images, etc. It is particularly clever to attract attention through, I quote, the skillful use of a peculiar experience based on the natural law that every color produces its opposite color. And he demonstrates this using an example of after images, which had been intensively discussed in the contemporary perception psychology by, amongst others, Ewald Hering and Sigmund Exner. I know you probably all did that sometime somewhere in a journal. You know, you look at the cross in the circle below, and when you draw away your face, then you can still see the advertisement before your closed eyes. As this advertisement from Peers, a soap manufacturer who had been producing soap since 1807, shows, contemporary psychophysiological knowledge could be of use for advertising. Of particular interest was research into attention, association, and suggestibility, which supplemented economic analysis of the structure of needs with knowledge of the consumer psyche. A couple of years later, around 1900, the first experimental psychological works that focused explicitly on advertising appeared, contributing in yet another way to the emergence of the consumer society by offering explanations for phenomena that were not accessible in everyday advertising. In 1900, the American psychologist Harlow Stearns Gale published On the Psychology of Advertising, probably the earliest psychological study on the subject. Between 1880 and 1890, According to the concrete background of his research, the number of newspapers and magazines had doubled from 10,000 to 20,000. The growth rate of advertising pages had increased by around four times. He studied the Century magazine in the 1880s. At the same time, the combination of text and image became more and more sophisticated. At the center of Gale's interest stood the process of convincing the potential buyer, whose attention had to be attracted first so that a need could be suggested to him or her that could be satisfied by purchasing the product whose brand had to be remembered. In 1895, on the advice of experts in the advertising industry, Gale sent out a questionnaire to about 200 local companies in which he described his goal of studying the mental processes, I quote, which go on in the minds of customers from the time they see the advertisement until they have purchased the article advertised, end quote. The evaluation of the survey showed that advertising, I quote again, might be characterized as an intentional means used to associate in the buyer's mind any article or group of articles of commerce with a particular make of that article or with a particular seller of it, end quote. With the term associate, Gale referred to one of the basic psychological mechanisms in addition to attracting attention and remembering the article. The decisive factor in the mechanisms of arousing attention and association was that the ideas induced by advertising were able to take over the psyche of potential consumers below the threshold of consciousness, to displace other ideas and to become dominant. That is, that they had a suggestive effect, as the applied psychologist Hugo Münsterberg called it. This was not uncontroversial among advertisers. They repeatedly emphasized that there was honest advertising that wanted to convey information to customers about the product they needed. Von Dillmann also insisted, quote, advertising can therefore be considered solid as long as it appeals to the higher nature of man, end quote. Only a good product, that is, deserves to be brought to buyers through advertising. And yet, in the same issue of the journal from 1892, the businessman Max Horwitz pointed out that advertising has a better effect when it is received unconsciously. Quote, then again, when it is done in such a tactful, unobtrusive manner, it scurries past us almost unnoticeably and practically steals into our proximity. It can be sure that it will most likely achieve its purpose because the more veiled the intention, the less it is noticed. End quote. This shows a transformation in advertising practice that, in my opinion, is more than a transition from the loud Reklame advertising to the subtle Werbung advertising. Rather, it indicates a closure of the communicative system of advertising. Advertising is freed from its external moral references. The moral interpretation of dishonorable advertising, which refers back to the criticism of pharmaceutical advertising and thus to the 18th century, gives way to the belief in the economic and communicative necessity and independence of advertising. Quote, but the surest method of advertising is the one that surrounds us without our even noticing it, and that conceals its true character by putting on an innocent face. Again, quote from Horwitz. Hence, the psychological mechanism of its addressees, the consumers, must be understood and exploited. Gale described the involuntary communication that this refers to as it takes place in the form of suggestion in the following way. After getting the attention, there's one effect we have not considered, but a most important one practically and extremely interesting psychologically. This is the unconscious effect of finally buying an article which has been continually reiterated before our half-conscious eyes. Having the simple name constantly forced before one's indirect vision is enough to make many people react sufficiently to get the article. And this without necessarily any curiosity or other reason, but simply as a case under our general law of sensory motor or idea motor reaction. This law merely sums up the natural tendencies to put into motion and carry out any perception or idea we may get. Thus, the final buying of the often impressed article is very similar to all the forms of suggestion. Within hypnotism, or in the commoner forms about us every day, which are being recognized as forming such a large part of our motor life. End quote. Gale's considerations are of particular interest because the act of buying is described as an effect of suggestion, as an idiomotoric reaction. This involves the neurophysiological phenomenon known as the Carpenter effect, whereby the thought of a movement itself is capable of triggering it, at least in tendency. Maybe you know this, there's this experiment. If I raise my hand and you stand there like this, then there seems to be something like an urge to raise your hand as well. And that's what Carpenter, a British neurophysiologist from the 19th century, worked on. In 1852, the English brain physiologist William Benjamin Carpenter saw the distinction between automatic and voluntary activity as the only firm basis of education and self-discipline, as he put it. He regarded an idiomotoric reaction as an automatic movement induced by an idea, such as occurs under hypnosis, in madness, in a state of drunkenness, or generally as a result of acquired habits. Carpenter was aiming at wrong consumption, primarily the consumption of alcohol and other luxury goods, such as tobacco, that were weakening one's nerves. And he popularized this principle via temperance tracts that he issued. What is crucial for my thesis of the emergence of the consumer as a communicative figure is that the concept of deliberate control and of rational control of automatic movements shifted in the course of the 19th century. While the observation of the revolution and the German campaign of 1813 at the beginning of the century, for example, in the work of the neurophysiologist Johann Christian Reil, had supported a specific modeling of the irrational and instinctual, which equated the social and political masses with the unconscious, in the middle of the century, within the framework of association psychology, the unconscious was no longer fundamentally considered risky. Still, attention always had to be directed in such a way that certain ideas, needs, and passions did not sink below what Johann Friedrich Herbert called the threshold of consciousness, and thus could become habitual. In the late 19th century, the concept of attention became fundamental to the constitution of the human psyche and, in particular, to the effective control of consumer decisions. Almost all of the contributions to Exner's 1892 discussion and self-help guidebook Moderne Reklame point to the importance of effective product staging, to the possibilities of attracting attention and anchoring the product in the consumer's memory. In particular, the attention value of so-called Streckenreklame, so I don't know how to translate that, that's something like advertisements alongside rail tracks and streets. So in particular, the attention value of so-called Streckenreklame was particularly high due to its inevitability, according to Ludwig Pickert, a representative of the Verband Deutscher Reklamefachleute, and I quote, "It even commands attention from those who are inaccessible to other forms of advertising. Offers, advertisements, cliches, brochures, catalogs can go unnoticed, even in their most sophisticated and effective form. But the viewer cannot escape the permanent poster, which typically appears everywhere and is imprinted on the mind with particular intensity through this constant, almost rhythmic repetition. That is why poster advertising is particularly appropriate for branded goods whose product name have a slogan effect. The trademark is practically hammered into the consumer's consciousness. End quote. The psychological structure of consciousness and unconsciousness, attention and distraction, had now shifted again, however. Whereas in 1800, the unconscious had to be suppressed, and in the middle of the century, it had to be observed, it was now to be exploited by means of targeted suggestion. While wrong consumption had given rise to the moral category of the consumer, it now lost its moral significance and became transformed into an economic category thanks to the newer theories of the psyche and of need structures. Consumers were no longer morally reprehensible, irrational people who failed to focus attention on their needs so that they could control them, and that is for physical reasons. The stabilizing function of attention had been lost. As Hermann von Helmholtz noted, quote, "The natural unconstrained state of our attention is to wander around to ever new things." And that's basically a theory that has been taken over by all psychologists, whether in England, for instance, Braid, or in France, Ribot, and in other countries. This meant that successful advertising had to attract and modulate the attention of potential consumers, had to exploit their wandering nature and direct their concentration suggestively. The self-discipline of needs under conditions of scarcity had given way to controlling them externally under conditions of increasing mass production. Not simply because of economic development, however, but because the consumer psyche had been constituted. Here, scientific knowledge had an impact on socioeconomic development, especially in dense urban life. According to the social psychologist Gabriel Tarde, imitation processes were becoming even ever easier and faster. Here, everything new had a hypnotic effect that captured attention and made the psyche easily subject to manipulation. Quote, "In this special state of exclusive and strong attention, strong and passive imagination, these dismayed and feverish beings irresistibly experience the magical charm of their new environment. They believe everything they see, everything that is done." A similar argument was made by the Chicago psychologist Walter Dill Scott, referring to the research into hypnosis and suggestion at the end of the century. "In the past," Scott clarified, "people had assumed that humans were rational beings, but today they tended to assume that humans were universally subject to suggestion." To specifically influence the psyche of potential consumers, one therefore had to examine the possibilities of suggestion. Scott explained it by means of an advertisement for cereal-based coffee from the American Postrim Cereal Company, founded in 1895, the market leader in coffee substitutes and soon one of the largest food companies of the USA. The portrait of a venerable doctor depicted there is associated in the mind with the judgment that Postrim coffee is healthy and would be trusted even later on, according to Scott in The Psychology of Advertising in Theory and Practice from 1908. The old moral argument of rational self-control thus reappears in form of an advertising strategy that relies on autosuggestion conveyed through the authority of the doctor figure. I come to my third chapter and the conclusion, autosuggestion and the autonomy of consumer needs. In order to effectively generate consumer needs in view of the growing importance of mass media and mass production, advertising had to succeed in circumventing the presence situation, the Anwesenheitssituation, which was considered a prerequisite for successful suggestion. According to Hugo Münsterberg, this was because while the salesman appeals to one person, the advertisement can reach millions. and has to awaken the impulse to buy everywhere, and can strengthen this impulse by every means which aids the suggestive power of the proposition and strengthens the general suggestibility." End quote. The psychoeconomic transformation required the definition of a psychological mechanism that advertising could target. Ideally, consumers had to be encouraged to suggest to themselves the need to purchase the item that had caught their attention. And this is where autosuggestion comes in. It had first been researched in the context of clinical studies on hysteria, even if it was not initially explicitly defined as such. In his foreword of the translation of Hippolyte Bernheim's Die Suggestion und ihre Heilwirkung, so a translation of Sigmund Freud, the original title is De la Suggestion et de ses applications à la thérapeutique, originally published in 1886. So in his translation of that, Sigmund Freud criticized Bernheim for not making a careful distinction between suggestion and autosuggestion. In Freud's view, Bernheim had often worked with indirect suggestions, it as stimulations for autosuggestion that, I quote, contain an objective element independent of the doctor's will, end quote. It lay in the patient's specific associations and states of excitement. Similarly, Swiss psychiatrist Auguste Forel, in his work Der Hypnotismus, emphasized that the mechanism of autosuggestion, I quote, is perhaps best illustrated by the fact that the inspiration of the hypnotist can never be completely adequate to the reaction he evokes in the hypnotized, end quote. He attributed this to the arbitrariness and ambivalence of symbolic communication and to neuronal automatisms. Forel emphasized that the autosuggestive interpretation and completion of some suggestions occurs on the basis of cognitive habits. Quote, "Typical autosuggestions are a product of the brain, and they abound in all healthy people. For example, every evening we are under autosuggestion if we can only fall asleep in a certain familiar position." End quote. Münsterberg also spoke of habits which work as autosuggestions in both directions, and Bernheim pointed out the possibility of deliberately modeling such habits. Quote, "The more often one evokes such phenomena, according to Bernheim, the easier it becomes, according to the law of association habituation, to evoke them again." End quote. What Bernheim, Forel, Münsterberg describe here is an act of self-deception that Niklas Luhmann identified as the central function of the mass media system of advertising because it stabilizes the relationship between redundancy and variety of products. If the stimulation of autosuggestion succeeds, the consumption of a product can be made permanent. One can have autosuggestions and be absolutely unable to consciously defend oneself against them, says Forel, referring to his own coffee consumption. So finally, and let me just briefly return to my thesis. As production and consumption became increasingly removed from each other, new media were needed to maintain communication. Advertising, as part of the modern mass media, functioned as a mediator here, as the phenomenon of advertising in particular shows. But this by no means makes the individual as a psychological system unimportant for social integration. On the contrary, the individual becomes crucial for the reproduction of society. A successful suggestion of needs presupposes the constitution of the consumer. For only when their psychological makeup is recognized and exploited can new variants of the same goods be wanted, recognized, and purchased, and the system thus reproduced. In other words, it is in this way that the fragile status of consumption can be stabilized. In the figure of the consumer, the emerging consumer society becomes self-reflexive. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.